recognizing, as we've been studying the Psalms already, saw last week Psalms 3 and 4, and we'll be seeing quite a number of times yet to come in our study of the Psalms, that for all the joy I'm feeling right now and being fit and healthy and all the rest of that, tomorrow may not be the case. Tomorrow the grass ball has made strike. Tomorrow may I have a flat tire. Tomorrow I may have who knows how many different kinds of problems. And so we're going to be looking in a moment at yet another psalm that deals with struggling along with problems. But you know what, brethren? In this country, we just hardly have problems at all sometimes, is the way I feel about it. I met this man right here, that's Alan Kitchen, back in 1975. He and I shared an apartment for a few weeks, as a matter of fact, when I first moved to the Northwest. He's the individual we told you about last week. I mentioned several times. He's now in Africa and working there on his 13th trip, as a matter of fact, since 1999. So he's been very, very active there. It's a gentleman that he's with is sort of his right-hand man over there and working with him. And just behind Alan, you'll notice that stack of books right there. And this is that stack, though I think not all of it. So that those of you who did contribute to the purchase of Bibles for Africa, these are the books that he was able to buy, a total of 1,280 of them. And I was asked in the course of the week, and so I checked it out here and wanted to show you now, whether or not these were in English or if they were in the native tongue of the people there. And as you can see, they're in the native tongue. They're not English translations. They are their own translations there. And so on Alan's behalf, I'd just like to thank all of you that participated in that. It's been a very effective work. He'll be there for quite some weeks to come. But as you look back, if I can go back to page 2 here, at the very sparse circumstances that he'll be living in and experiencing in that time, it's hard for us really to complain, at all. And yet, brethren, there are circumstances in life, and whether you are wealthy or not, as we certainly are in this country, where you will be struggling and justifiably so, and where you have good reason to be miserable and unhappy, to recognize that life is not going as you would like it to do. And when those times come, you're burdened. You're overburdened. You're worried. You're concerned. And while the Scripture tells us to be anxious for nothing in the Philippian letter, yet nonetheless, it would be equally wrong to just behave as if nothing is happening and to ignore the circumstances, and to act as if it's a birthday party when you're having a tough time. That's inappropriate as well. And so we are to find a sort of a middle ground, I guess. And no man is better qualified. And I don't think even Job is better qualified to give us information about the worries of this life and how we are to face them. David had more problems than Job did, in my view. Job got struck down essentially all at once over a short period of time. He suffered horrifying losses, but he also saw the return of his health and another family. He can never replace one, but still yet he went on to very fruitful years and would have other sons and daughters and regain his wealth, as well as his health, whereas David would have wave after wave after wave after wave from a very young age throughout his entire life and down to the very end, in which he was just constantly burdened with problems that in some senses, like being responsible for a civil war and 20,000 people dying as a direct result, your sins creating these kinds of problems that, Job never even experienced. If you're looking for advice on how to handle life when it's turning against you, when you see the storm clouds lowering and a tornado about to touch down, or when you're in the midst of the maelstrom, it's David that can give us information on that. So, even though last week we dealt with the same material, the same circumstances, and the same ideas, that is, how to cope with life's problems, last week in Psalms 3 and 4. We're going to do it again this morning in Psalm 5, and we'll have occasion to do it again, maybe more than once, in the future lessons as well, because David never says in one psalm, here's how to handle all of life's problems. Dip, 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 and that's it, and I'll never write on the subject again. Instead, as he's moving through his life and experiencing a wide variety of different kinds of circumstances, he will then take up the pen and be led by the Holy Spirit as well as by his own heart with these experiences to speak of them and to give counsel on how to handle them. And he's not going to give the same advice every single time. He will be giving us cumulatively a very large body of information on strategies and things that we can employ in order to successfully be without anxiety, though we are suffering in the midst of everything and anything that life can throw at us. And so, if you'll turn, please, now to Psalm number 5, we're going to do precisely as we did last week in Psalms 3 and 4, line by line, through each of the things that he says here, recognizing then that when this man who is after God's own heart reveals what he did, that we have him standing before us as a divine example, as God's established example of what it is that we ought to be doing. So, number one, in the three verses. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my groaning. Heed the sound of my cry for help, my King and my God. For to you do I pray. In the morning, O Lord, you will hear my voice. In the morning I will order my prayer to you and eagerly watch. Now, in this psalm, all he mentions is the morning. But as you well know, in other places, we'll find out that he was also praying during the day. And we'll find out that he was praying in the evening. And we'll find out that he was praying at midnight, late at night. We're going to find out that David really knew how to pray. But he started his day that way. And so as you look at groaning, my cry, here he is, in the morning ordering his prayer. This is a problem that he's been carrying now for some time. Unlike Psalm 3, which you can probably look just across the page and see, where we have the uninspired, historical record, but apparently accurate, that he had written that psalm at a particular time in his life, during the revolt of Absalom, his son. This one doesn't tell us what the circumstances are. I don't know what he was groaning about. I don't know what he was crying to God about on this particular occasion. But it's something that's been weighing on him at least overnight that he now, first thing in the morning, is going to bring it before his God, likely not for the first time. Certainly, it's been on his mind overnight, apparently. Maybe this is the second time, the third time, the 50th time, the 100th time that he has approached God about this particular problem. And he is saying, though, from sunrise here, or from bedrise, when I rise in the morning, I will be offering my words, my groaning, and my cry for help to you. And notice how he emphasizes it at the end of verse 2. To you! He's not turning to any human being. He's not turning to any idol. He's not even turning to his own resources. He is turning to his God throughout the day and immediately as he now rises to say, here's my problem. Here's what I'm facing. Dear God, let me not forget to bring my burden before you. So, hear my voice. Twice he mentions the morning. It is you, and we might add alone, to whom I speak. Now, watch what happens in verses 4, 5, and 6. There's a reason given for this morning prayer. For you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness. No evil dwells with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do iniquity. You destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the man of bloodshed and deceit. Wow! Well, the only thing he's asked for so far is hear my groaning and my prayer. There's no specific request that's been made. And then he immediately turns to what is a lot of information in those three verses about wicked people. about evil, which we've studied the last 2 weeks, as a matter of fact, in the Proverbs on Wednesday nights. He stops to think before he begins his day, first thing in the course of his prayer, and apparently thereafter, you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness. Did you get up this morning, first day of the week in which you knew that you were going to prepare yourself both mentally and physically, put on, you know, clothing appropriate, and come down and be with the saints? Did you think this morning, first thing, about that quality of God in verse 4? Did you think about how it is that God takes no pleasure in wickedness? You know, I was going to preach this lesson and I didn't. I honestly didn't. Had this on my mind. But I didn't, when I popped up my eyes this morning, you know, think, God really hates wickedness. That'll change things for the whole day. First, it plants an idea in your own mind, so I better not engage in any. God hates wickedness. No evil dwells in him. As I now pass through this day, I will always be in the presence of one in whom there is no evil at all. Because he despises it. He hates it. Then he says, the boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all those who do iniquity. And by the way, for all I said about the suffering of David, did he, you know, have a triumph or two in his time? Could David be a man who might have been sorely tempted by arrogance and pride? You know, if I killed a bear and a lion and the sheep, I might tell that story time or two. No, I can see how you'd have reason to think, oh yeah, I've done some pretty amazing things. I killed Goliath when I was a kid. I, therefore, encourage all the troops of Israel. In fact, I call them out on their faithlessness and then prove my point when I killed Goliath. I have overcome many armies. Personal attack to Saul himself. I've done a sin or two. We have what's on his mind. The Lord hates evil. There's none in him. And he doesn't like boastful people either. He is ordering his thoughts then for the course of that day. And I think it is more, brethren, than just saying, boy, the Lord hates them. So he's on my side. Now, there may be some of that, and I think that's all right. God hates evil, and so, you know, he'll take care of it. But it looks to me more like first thing in the morning, you know, he's planting these ideas in his own mind. What does he say in verse 6? You destroy those who speak falsehood. David ever speak any falsehood? Yeah. Yeah. One of his most spectacular sins involves some of that. And thou art the man. And then we have, in the last part of verse 6, you abhor the man of bloodshed and deceit. David had been deceitful about what had happened with Bathsheba before and after. And the sword would never depart from his house. He was a man of bloodshed, and because of that fact, was forbidden to build the temple. It was his heart's desire. It would be left to his son, Solomon, to build that temple. Obviously, this bloodshed is likely speaking of an outright murder, which is inexcusable. And so, someone who is not in a battle for the Lord. But nonetheless, he is a man of bloodshed. He's a man of blood. He was driven into it because of mistakes that he himself had made. Brethren, here's advice not offered at all in Psalms 3 and 4 about handling your problems. If you are groaning with life's problems, and when you wake up in the morning, they're first thing on your mind, and you say, Lord, hear my cry. Listen to my groaning. The next thought ought to be, oh, how the Lord hates wickedness, deceitfulness, and lying, and bloodshed. And it'll cause us to wake up and say, I want none of these things. David's spending a considerable amount of time on them. Then he says in verse 7, but as for me, by thine abundant loving kindness, I will enter your house at your holy temple. I will bow down in reverence for you. Lord, I am really burdened. I am really suffering. I appreciate how much you hate evil and there's none of that in you. So look for me in your temple. Look for me in your presence. Look for me among your people. Look for me in worship. Look for me where you are. That's where I'm going to go. I'm going to the temple. So what David is now saying, you know, in the course of his prayer is, I am committed to the worship of my God so that this burden that I'm carrying, whatever it was, that causes the first breath out of my lips to be a groan when I wake up in the morning, will not prevent me from my duty. It will not prevent me from being in that temple. It will not prevent me from going there to be in the presence of my God. I understand you hate evil. So where should I be? I should be in God's tabernacle slash temple. Now you understand, he hasn't built the big structure that Solomon would. But there on that mountain above him, David intended, and there's the ark, that he is wanting to encompass with a great temple. He will go into the presence of God because that tabernacle is right there, and as a matter of fact, just up the hill a few steps from where he himself is living. So brethren, if you're ever tempted to say, my life is just too busy with problems, and the Lord will understand. Remember that you've never had problems like David's. And when David was in the midst of a particularly bad one apparently here, he said, you know where to look for me. Among God's people, in God's presence, at God's location, I'm going to be there at the tabernacle. I'm going to be at the temple. In verse 8, what he next says is, so no excuses, I'm going to take care of you, God's work. In verse 8, he says, O Lord, lead me in your righteousness because of my foes. Make your way straight before me. Now think about that verse 8 for just a minute, brethren. Lead me in righteousness. Why? Lead me in righteousness because of your foes. What did he say there? What if he had said, lead me in righteousness because of your friends? He didn't pick friends, he picked foes. Why lead me in righteousness because of foes? In my guess, brethren, my idea on this is that David is recognizing there will be temptation in the course of this day. I need to make certain that I don't succumb to it. I need to commit myself to worship, but I also need to commit myself now to individual right behavior, to righteousness. I need to make absolutely certain that when my foes come against me, and I'm tempted to anger, I'm tempted to rage, I'm tempted to who knows how many things. By the way, how was it that David came to be married to Abigail? Remember her? Do you remember the story of how he met and would later marry Abigail? But because her husband, Nabal, had sinned against him, cheated him, withheld his wages and the wages of his men who had been protecting Nabal, he then finds out he's going to get cheated, and in a rage, he flew off the handle, and he made a vow, or at least, you know, he was committed to the idea that not one male in the household of all the reaches of Nabal's influence, very wealthy guy with a lot of servants, not one man would be left alive by the end of that day. Well, who did he meet? In his rage, murderous rage, on the way to Nabal's house. And Abigail, the fool's wife, okay? She convinced him, long story short, David, you're really blowing it here. You're really messing up. David, you're not behaving righteously. David, your rage has run away with you. You're acting in anger. You're about to make a mistake. God's going to hold you accountable for it. This is real wrong. And she swayed him. She changed his mind. David's been there, done that. So what's developing here, brethren, is David saying, here's how you order your day when the previous day was really bad. So the first thought in your mind when you woke up was groaning and crying. God, help me. See, nothing's happened in the day yet. It's got to be carry forward from the one before.
What do you do?
Think about how God hates evil. Commit yourself to worship and righteousness. All he's really done in all three of these so far is to resolve himself that no matter how bad it is, there'll be no sin in me. No trial is so severe that I'll sin. No temptation is so great that I'll sin. No enemy is so vexatious that I'm going to overreact and say or do something that God would not approve. That's quite a way to face the day, isn't it? Now we come to verse 9. There is nothing reliable in what they say. Their inward part is destruction. Their throat is an open grave. Well, now really, this is just the same thing as God's hatred, isn't it? Only this really did focus on God's hatred. And this is now remembering those guys. But the terminology right there, nothing reliable, inward part destruction, throat is an open grave. There is nothing appealing about an open grave. And you've all probably looked down into a few in the course of your lives. And I am too. I don't want anything that's in an open grave or could come out of it. I want nothing from the throats of evil people. Whatever they might say, I want no part of that. I know where it originates, and I don't want to go there. It's the way that we always put it. So he was meditating on God's hatred of evil, but he's also meditating on just how disgusting, how vile, how revolting, how awful, how horrible that sinners and sin itself actually is. That's a lot of negative thinking in David's mind. But it's very powerful persuasion against participating in it when we come to verse 10. And he said, I guess I left off and flattered with their tongue too. But in verse 10, hold them guilty, O God. By their own devices let them fall. In the multitude of their transgressions thrust them out, for they are rebellious against you. Now, after a recent lesson, and I think it was one of the Psalms, I'm not sure, Bill Kohler, I think it was, came up and he asked me about David's attitude towards sinners and how he sometimes calls God's wrath down upon them. So we had a brief conversation about this just recently. We're going to look into some Psalms, brethren, that go way beyond what he does in verse 10. But in verse 10, he sure enough says, hold them guilty, O God. By their own devices let them fall. What did he say there? Whatever they were going to do against me, let it happen to them. Well, what they've been plotting against David, and we know a lot about his life, was hideously bad stuff. So he's saying, let hideously bad stuff come upon them. In the multitude of their transgressions, thrust them out, for they are rebellious against you. He is calling for God's wrath. He is calling specifically for the same thing that they were perpetrating to fall upon them. But you notice what I got in the parentheses, don't you? There's a caution here that we have to remember when we cry for vengeance. And we've already seen it in our Wednesday night studies, but in the next book, Proverbs, everybody turn over to Proverbs chapter 24. Hold this. We'll be right back to finish the psalm. It won't be much longer before the psalm's concluded. But look at Proverbs chapter 24 first. The 24th chapter, and we'll read it, then get your pencils ready, and over there at Psalm 5:10, maybe you'd want to write this reference in. But it's Psalm 24, look at verses 16 through 18. A righteous man falls seven times and rises again, Proverbs 24:16. But the wicked stumble in time of calamity. Then comes that warning, do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased and he turn his anger away from him. You will defeat justice and punishment. You will defeat the justice and punishment that you yourself desire if you take personal delight in it when it comes. God sees that.
He'll withdraw that punishment from the individual that you cry out to be punished in that manner. That's quite a caution there now, isn't it?
Now there's a fine line. And David crossed over it when it came to Nabal. And so he learned his lesson there. He may have crossed over it more than once. I know I have, and you maybe have too. To say, Lord, I have to learn how much you hate evil. I need to meditate on it myself. Now I'm going to commit myself to worship and to righteousness. But I do need to understand evil, how much you hate it, how bad it is. And then, Lord, I'm going to call that folks will reap what they sow. And then I'm going to be very careful that when they do fall by their own devices because you punish them for their sins, that I don't take pleasure in it. That I still am grieved. It causes me sorrow. I wish it hadn't happened. It is justice. But let me ask a trick question. Brethren, do you really want justice? Then if I add, for others, yes, but if I add it for yourself, what do you want instead of justice? Mercy, grace, loving kindness, forgiveness, redemption. So, very fine line. To call and desire justice is right and proper and good, and God is all about that. To enjoy it when it happens is wrong. And will even subvert the very justice that you're hoping for from the standpoint that God then may relent. Let's go now back to Psalm 5, verses 11 and 12, the final verses of the Psalm. Let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy. And may you shelter them, that those who love your name may exult in you. That's a strong word for joy. For it is you who bless the righteous man, O Lord. You surround him with favor as with a shield. So, brother, go ahead and make your request. Whatever it is, the freedom you want from the trouble or the gain that you're hoping for, whatever it is, you know, you're looking for, make the request. When he says, let all who take refuge in you be glad, there's at least, you know, a hint of an idea right there that you get what you want. Lord, I'll be happy when you give me what I want. So, let me have my request, what I've taught. Brother, you know what else is there? It's the recognition that that request may not be answered immediately. It may not be answered soon. So what should you do while you're waiting for the answer to your prayer concerning grievous circumstances? What do you learn to do? James said, count it all joy. Encounter various trials. So David apparently is trying to do this as well. Lord, here's my request. Here's what I want. Please, you know, grant this thing. But I think in verses 11 and 12, it's not just that. It's also, let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy. May you shelter them. Those who love your enemy, love thy name, may exult in you. For it's you who bless the righteous man. You surround him with a shield. Friend, the only time you ever need a shield is when you're under attack. So David said, here I am behind my shield. And while I'm growing, that's the first thing that happens in the morning. And I'm going through my list of how to handle it. I am not going to forget that I also need to be happy while I'm waiting for my request to be granted. I will learn to count it all joy. Lord, your shield, so even behind my shield, I'm going to learn how to grin. So I'm going to figure out how to be happy and accept the circumstances and get on with my life. It's a pretty amazing psalm, brethren, with all sorts of advice that we did not have in the third and the fourth. But what's the point of Psalm 3, Psalm 4, Psalm 5, and a host of others? God has promised that he will care for you. God has promised and even put a symbol in the sky to remind us about his mercy and about his discipline and self-control, and how that after punishments fall, he restrains himself and promises then, in that case, of course, with Noah, that it'd never be that severe again, say, we come to the final judgment. Your good days will come too. So when you start off a day with a tornado, usually attended by very heavy rain, and when it passes, the sun comes out, what have you got? God's very promise in the sky. I know what you're going through. I understand all of this. And I promise you, ultimately, it's going to be great beyond knowing. It's just great, great. And no price you pay is too high, is too much. David got it. So should we. So if you're struggling, if you're hurting, if you're in trouble, brethren, that's okay. It's understandable. Groan if you must. Hopefully we'll know about it and we'll be able to help you too. In the meantime, take David's advice. Meditate on how bad evil is. Commit yourself to worship and righteousness. Learn to be happy while it's going on, as James also said to do. Get about the business of life, making no excuses to ever be hindered in the service of your God. Life's problems are no excuse. Handle them the way David did. If we can help you in that, please let me know. Come speak with me as we finish.